I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've devoted our entire episode today to food and mental health. People have generously shared their stories over the hour, and now we're turning to Virji Tovar. She's a body image activist who says that what she does isn't about food, but about human rights. And she's here with us to talk about what that means for mental health. Virji!
Francis!
Thank you so much for talking with us. I'm really excited to talk with you. And I want to start actually with telling you a little bit about like my happy place, right?
Yes.
So I love going to restaurants. My wife and daughter are going away in a couple weeks, and I'm going to be sad to miss them. But honestly, I just keep thinking about, like, where am I going to go for dinner by myself? Like, I can't wait to go. Like, it really is. Like, for me, like, restaurants are, like, warm and they're inviting. And I really feel, like, happy when I'm in a restaurant. Like, I'll just be sitting at a bar, having an appetizer, and just feeling like, this is great. So it was really eye-opening for me when you made me realize that for a lot of people, going to restaurants is not that. It's, you know, actually can be a really stressful experience. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, so I think a lot about restaurants in terms of access because I am a bigger person. And so there's a lot of dimensions and thought that go into a regular experience, like going into a restaurant, which for many people really is just kind of a joyful experience. For me, it sort of starts even before I even get to the restaurant. So I'm thinking about how much space is there in the waiting area where the line is, and am I going to be in the way? I think about my favorite coffee place, and there's this very narrow area, and it always gives me this little hit of anxiety. And then I think about, so what am I going to order? And am I going to have to worry about the people within earshot judging me? Am I going to have to worry about the cashier thinking some kind of way? So, and am I going to, for instance, get the whipped cream on the coffee that I like so much because they make it in-house? Am I going to get that hit of, oh, she's bigger, so she shouldn't be getting whipped cream on her coffee? And then there's kind of this other dimension of, am I going to sit and eat the thing or drink the thing? Because eating in public is really vulnerable when you're a bigger bodied person, I think, especially if you're a woman. And then there's the dimension of the seating. Am I going to be able to fit in the chair, number one? And more importantly, perhaps, am I going to be able to sit there comfortably to actually enjoy the thing? And so there's kind of all of these different components that go into it that are sort of hidden, but that are very real and very layered in the mind of someone like me.
That's so interesting. And we even in the food industry, we always talk about, like, it's welcoming. It's about bringing people to the table. And it's like, oh, no, you literally did not make a table that many, many people who would otherwise be happy to come there, you know, feel comfortable sitting in.
Yeah. I live in San Francisco, and it's a very design-conscious city. And minimalism is kind of the height of design here at this in this moment. And I don't know. I think a lot of people find minimalist seating, for instance, to be quite uncomfortable. But for me, it's physical discomfort, but it's also there's like a mental health hit that happens because I'm used to sort of walking into a restaurant and thinking, oh, especially in a city like San Francisco, this place is not for me. This place is for very thin foodies. And so that tiny chair feeds into a narrative that I don't belong. And that's a narrative that I've been taught for a very long time, ever since I was a child.
Yeah. What other, like, basic things do thin people, or this is a term you taught me, straight-sized people, take for granted?
Yeah, I've been thinking so much about this. I've always been fat, so it's hard for me to have perspective. There are moments of realization where it just blows my mind. Like, for instance, someone had to explain to me that that thin people think that fat people are fat because we have this obscenely different lifestyle than thin people do, that we just eat significantly more and move significantly less than all thin people. And essentially, this is not data supported. I mean, like, You know, I can say, as someone who's researched this for a decade, this is not supported by data. And I, she sort of had to sit and explain it about 5 or 6 times for me to be able to understand that, oh, the data don't matter. What matters is that, you know, this is a discriminatory belief. This is like a victim blaming belief. Mm. And it doesn't make any sense because it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, a lot of thin people have been taught not to be friends with fat people. So if you don't have any fat friends, you don't know what our life looks like. And then on top of that, there's kind of this confirmation bias where we kind of discard information that goes against whatever deep-seated belief we have.
Sure.
And we kind of lean in very hard to information that confirms what we believe.
Sure.
And so there's multiple effects going on there, like multiple things that are creating the reality and perception of others. But that was a big one. I think another one that I'm thinking of, this is sort of a more recent sort of area of research that I've been looking into. The efficacy of important medications is not tested above a certain weight.
Mm.
And this, it was sort of made really international news. I think it was last year when they found out that a very popular form of emergency contraception in Europe lost efficacy at, I think it was 165 pounds and was completely useless, I think above 170 pounds.
Oh, God.
And to give context, I mean, this is Europe for sure, but like to give context in the United States, 68% of American women are a size 14 or above, meaning that they're sort of at that level.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And I think like another example is access to even fashion. You know, like having clothing available to you that makes you feel good, that makes you feel seen. And for a lot of people, a lot of plus size people, going into a store is a very stressful experience. It's a very stigmatizing experience, a very shameful experience.
Mm.
And so there's this real disempowerment that's built into fat phobic discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what that kind of stress does to people.
Yes. Yeah, so there is this phenomenon known as minority stress, and it's actually a body of research that looks at the cumulative effect of discrimination and sort of quantifies the physiological effects of stress among people who are marginalized, and that includes fat people. You know, stress, especially ongoing stress, affects the function of the heart. It affects the immune system. These are the issues that are connected with higher weight. And what minority stress theory is kind of attempting to posit is that it's actually typically the experience of discrimination that leads to negative health outcomes in people who are discriminated against and marginalized people. So a paper actually came out in 2015 that I thought pretty firmly posited that weight discrimination could lead to shortened life expectancy in higher weight people. And stress manifests in a lot of different ways. I want to talk about this thing called hypervigilance, sort of this constant state of awareness of how others are perceiving you, of attempting to kind of offset those things. It's about doing a lot of mental work around a really mental Olympics to try and prevent experiences of discrimination and or always being prepared for those moments.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you're a fat person in our culture where it is still socially acceptable to overtly express fat negative views, I certainly think that that is changing rapidly. We are constantly anticipating cruelty and negativity. And, you know, I think, again, increasingly there's less overt fat phobia happening in media and maybe even in social interactions in certain places. But they're still happening, and you never quite know when it's going to hit.
Right.
And when that moment hits, it is so utterly dehumanizing. It's so humiliating. And I think that it's that humiliation component that can be so deeply painful. Because, right, and the humiliation comes from the fact that you know you're living in a culture that corroborates this cruelty.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because it is about a culture. It's about a society. So what do you say to the arguments then that, you know, even if you're being pressured to be thin, well, isn't it better to be that way because it's, quote, healthier for you?
There's so much to say to that. I mean, I want to talk about, you know, the way that fat phobia taxes all of us, but the ways in which it kind of really does as you get larger in this culture, the way that that tax gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Do we have time to talk about this for a second?
Sure.
Let's do it. Okay, then I'm going to address this concern about health. So it's useful to look at a type of discrimination like fat phobia with a three-dimensional lens. So the first dimension I often talk about is the intrapersonal dimension. So this is how a person feels about themselves and their body. And when we're talking about this level, this is where we are seeing a lot of suffering and anguish, regardless of size. That moment in the mirror that accumulates into hundreds of thousands of moments over a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And then we look at the second dimension, which is the interpersonal. This is the relational and social dimension. So we know, for instance, that many employers have bias against plus size candidates. We know that doctors tend to judge fat patients more harshly. And we know that dating is harder for fat people. So that those are all things that are happening between people, and that's the interpersonal. And then there's the third dimension, which is the institutional dimension. And this is sort of the outside of human exchange dimension. It has to do with institutions, industries, the world in which you are living. Are these systems, are institutions accessible to you or not? And this includes something like education, right? Like the size of seating in classrooms, the size of seating in lecture halls. This includes access to fashion, what I was talking about earlier. So the fashion industry has long neglected the 68% of American women who are a size 14 or above. And then again, that efficacy of medication not being tested above a certain weight. Yeah. These are all things that are above the intra and the inter and make up the world that we're all navigating.
Sure.
And so when we're talking about the second and third dimension, the higher your weight, the more you're getting hit on both of those. And so this is how we create dimensionality around understanding how this issue affects people across the size spectrum. Yeah. And in terms of health, I mean, this is really interesting, right? Like in our culture, there is a false correlation between food, exercise, and body size. Most people who are thin are genetically predisposed towards having a smaller body. There are many, many, many fat people who exercise and eat vegan or any number of, you know, vegetable-based diets or what we would consider like nutritious diets and are still fat. And I think, you know, the fact that we don't see this speaks to a lot of things, right? Like it speaks to confirmation bias. It speaks to the lack of representation of fat people. It speaks to the ways in which thin people aren't having meaningful relationships with fat people, generally speaking, because of the fear of being stigmatized through proximity. I mean, really, our attitudes, and I can say this with complete confidence, our attitudes towards body size are archaic and they're not data informed. And discrimination really does become the area where we as a culture, and any culture, begins to have blind spots, begins to cherry pick data, begins to sort of like, you know, delete certain things and lean into others. And the truth is we need to accept that the current paradigm around how we understand health, how we understand food, how we understand science, size is not working. We need to stop worrying and wondering and questioning why people are the size that they are. Because at the end of the day, every single person deserves respect, care, love, proper medical care, full humanity, no matter what size they are or why they are that size.
Thank you so much, Virgie.
Yeah, of course.
That is activist and author Virgie Tovar. Her latest book is You Have the Right to Remain Fat, and she's working on a new one called Flawless. You can find a whole lot more about Virgie and her numerous projects at splendidtable.org. And there's also a resource list she created for anyone interested in positive body image or wanting help and support.